Enjoying Assassins? If you're getting out and about soon, pack a podcast that will take you on a real journey. Binge all seasons of the ABC's Expanse podcast.
What the hell?
There's spies, stories of survival, grand heists and supernatural sightings.
Whoops-a-daisy, what are we going to do?
I was just a bit mad.
These are the stories of Australia you might not have heard, but won't be able to stop talking about once you do.
I took off.
We got to save ourselves.
Death will come and I'll be ready for it.
Search Expanse to binge all seasons on the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, my friend. I'm Aslan Bahari, and today on Assassins, something special for you. While we're busy working on new episodes of the show, I thought I'd bring you the story of an assassination from our friends at If You're Listening. A few weeks ago, we told you the story of Mohsin Fakhrizadeh's assassination, most probably at the hands of Israel's national intelligence agency, Mossad. Well, it turns out this isn't the only assassination thought to have been carried out by Mossad in Iran. In this episode, host Matt Bevan brings you the story of the assassination of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh.
If You're Listening is recorded on the lands of the Awabakal, Darug and Eora people. Iran's most famous ski destination is Tokol Resort. It overlooks the capital, Tehran. You can get there on a 7-kilometre chairlift from the Tehran suburb of Tajrish. And on the way up the chairlift, if you turn around at just the right time, you can see something interesting. A giant walled-off area filled with lush green trees. In amongst the trees is the palace of the former Shah of Iran. His Majesty liked skiing, hence the convenient chairlift. These days, it's where the President of Iran holds big events and meets with world leaders. Right on the edge of the palace grounds is a concrete building 5 stories high. And if you happen to be on the chairlift at 1:37 a.m. on the 31st of July this year, you would have seen the western corner of that building explode. Windows were shattered, an exterior wall crumbled, and rubble fell onto the terrace below. Now, that explosion was no accident. It was the result of a bomb. A bomb that killed an extremely high-profile target.
Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh has been assassinated in the Iranian capital, Tehran.
This attack appears to have been meticulously planned and carried out flawlessly, probably by Israel.
As is its usual practice, the Israeli government has declined to make any official comment. The Mossad simply never comments at all.
But if that's true, it's wild. Killing a Hamas leader inside the compound of the Iranian president, while he's under the protection of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, is an extraordinary statement.
The Iran supreme leader said revenge was our duty and that Israel had prepared a harsh punishment for itself by killing a dear guest in our home.
There's some debate about the mechanics of how they pulled this off, which I'll definitely be getting into later in this episode. But no matter the methods they used, the risk involved in this assassination operation is extreme. If it was Israel that did this, why did they do it in such an extraordinary manner? Well, the answer is fascinating, and it tells us a lot about the incredibly complex political situation that Israel has found itself in, where it feels the need for revenge, but only in a way that doesn't alienate its allies. Today, the unbelievable assassination plot against Ismail Haniyeh and what it tells us about the escalating conflict between Israel and its enemies.
The world is on the brink of a full-scale war in the Middle East.
I'm Matt Bevan, and this is If You're Listening. The The Israeli intelligence agency Mossad was once considered to be one of the most terrifying, ruthless spy agencies in the world, known for its daring and brutal missions.
The kidnapping, trial and execution of Nazi Adolf Eichmann, the Israeli bombing of the Syrian nuclear reactor, assassinations of Iranian nuclear scientists.
The purpose of these plots was to communicate to Israel's enemies that there was nowhere they could hide without Mossad finding them. And yet, for nearly a decade, Ismail Haniyeh, leader of Israel's number one enemy, Hamas, has been
living in Qatar for safety, security. The Israelis would like to kill him, would have liked to have killed him even before he was killed last night.
He's not alone. A bunch of Hamas leaders live in Qatar. It's a weird setup. Billionaire gas princes, the US military, and Hamas all living next door to each other on the Arabian Peninsula. And they're not hiding there either. They live out in the open. Ismail Haniyeh spent years there and nothing happened to him. You might think that sending your spies to assassinate your greatest enemies would be easier to do in a country that you share a bunch of allies with, but it's not. And the reason for that goes back to a series of Mossad operations that went terribly, terribly wrong.
Israelis once saw their foreign intelligence service as invincible. Not anymore.
Throughout the 90s and 2000s, Mossad bungled a few really high-profile missions.
The Mossad used to have the image of working like a Swiss clock, and now it is almost like a Swiss cheese full of holes.
But the biggest of all their screw-ups came in 2010, and that's because they screwed up in a very particular way.
This is the spy story that could well spell the end of old-fashioned cloak-and-dagger espionage.
This time, the operation was in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. The target? Hamas's top weapons supplier, a man named Mahmoud al-Mabou.
The Palestinian resistance fighter was known to Mossad for buying weapons from Iran and notorious also for kidnapping and killing two Israeli soldiers in 1989.
It was called Operation Plasma Screen. I assume Mossad had run out of intimidating operation names and had moved on to household appliances. It involved more than 20 Mossad agents, all travelling on non-Israeli passports. That's really necessary for the operation to work. At the time, more than two dozen countries, including the UAE, did not accept Israeli passports. So while the CIA and MI6 can print Jack Ryan and James Bond new passports whenever they like, Mossad agents have to use foreign passports. Without those foreign passports, there's no Operation Plasma Screen, not to mention Operation DVD Player, Operation Lazy Boy Recliner, and Operation Universal Remote. So how do you get hold of foreign passports? Well, apparently, Israel developed a system.
If you're an Israeli with two passports, be that second passport British or Australian, you can be approached by an official.
The official asks you if you need that second passport in the short term. And if you say no,
you're asked if, out of duty to the country, whether you'd be prepared to have your passport details borrowed.
Borrowed. Best no one asks what they're being borrowed for. Operation Plasma Screen would require more than 20 of these borrowed passports. Using fake passports more than once is risky. They'd have to get the job done with as few visits to Dubai as possible. On visit one, the agents followed al-Mabou around Dubai, observing his patterns. On visit two, they slipped poison in his drink, but he inconveniently failed to die and went home to Syria, thinking that he was just sick. 2 months later, alive and well, he headed back to Dubai. Spies travelling on the same set of passports followed him again.
Mabou arrives from Damascus mid-afternoon and is watched by several operatives. The man in the baseball cap goes by the name of Australian Adam Corman.
Virtually the entire operation is captured on CCTV. Israeli operatives follow al-Mabou from the airport to the hotel. When he goes to his room, two spies with tennis rackets manage to slide into the lift with him. I hate it when people do that. One of the tennis players watches which room he goes into.
The operatives book a room opposite, and still more agents move in. And when the Hamas man leaves to go shopping, he's followed every step.
It's quite funny watching these surveillance teams go about their business. You can see them changing disguises into business suits, pushing on doors that say pull, endlessly wandering up and down hotel corridors like weird business ghosts. Meanwhile, four of them break into Al-Mabou's room.
The Hamas official arrives back from his shopping trip and into the ambush of four assassins.
They use a special ultrasonic device to anaesthetize him without a needle and lower him to the floor, waiting for his heart to stop. But they aren't out of the woods yet.
Once a team like this starts working, it is very easy technologically to trace them at each and every point of the whole maneuver.
Unlike in the movies, they don't have a guy in a van who hacks into the security system and erases the CCTV footage. The whole thing is caught on camera. Their only hope is that nobody will ever bother to check it. So they take off Al-Mabou's clothes and tuck him into bed. It'll look like he died in his sleep.
In the absence of signs of a struggle, for days police thought he died of natural causes. And with agents safely out of the country, it seemed the perfect hit.
It was the passports that blew their cover. After Hamas notified Dubai police that their man was dead, it was simple for investigators to check immigration logs for anything suspicious. They discovered that the same group of people had clearly been following Al-Mabou in and out of the country.
Dubai police say Mahmoud Al-Mabou's killers tracked him from the moment he arrived in the country. Warrants are now being issued for their arrest.
Which was a bit of a nasty surprise for the people who the passports belong to.
Imagine waking up one morning only to find out that apparently you've travelled to an exotic Middle Eastern location and assassinated an alleged arms dealer.
The Australians, Brits, Irish, French and Germans whose passports had been used were not very happy.
I'm angry. Why is this happening to me? Does this mean I can't visit my parents because someone used my name? It's like a movie.
The governments of the countries the passports came from were also not very happy. They are all friendly with Israel, and here was their ally using their passports for international assassinations.
Such misuse of British passports is intolerable. The fact that this was done by a country which is a friend only adds insult to injury.
This was not the act of a friend. This is not the first occasion where there has been misuse of an Australian passport by Israeli agencies.
Needless to say, Dubai was angry too.
That is a deplorable and unacceptable method of operation.
It was extremely embarrassing and damaging for Israel. Israel relies on the support of its allies, well, for its very existence. They couldn't risk doing this again in a place like Dubai. That's why Hamas's headquarters are now in Qatar.
The Americans had an agreement with the Qataris and the Israelis that you don't kill Hamas leaders in Qatar.
This has provided a challenge for Israel, which
previously pledged to eliminate Hamas leaders.
When those leaders aren't in Qatar, they're in other highly developed Western allied countries like Egypt and Turkey. If you're a spy for a country that's pledged to eliminate Hamas leaders, it might be easier for you to get them there logistically, but diplomatically, it's kryptonite. When those leaders travel to meet their allies in Iran, though, well,
the Palestinian militant group Hamas says its political leader, Ismail Haniyeh, has been assassinated in Iran.
So, how'd they pull it off? Mossad couldn't get Ismail Haniyeh in Qatar, where he lived, so they'd have to get him while he was travelling. Mossad knew that Haniyeh travelled regularly to Tehran. Mossad also knew that he stayed in the guest house of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps on the edge of the presidential palace complex at the foot of the mountains. It seems they had also managed to bribe two of the building's guards, offering them cash and asylum in Europe in exchange for attaching a brick-sized bomb to the bottom of Haniyeh's bed. They had the where and the how, but they were missing the when. You can't have a crew of Mossad agents hiding in the hills of Tehran, endlessly staking out the building waiting for your guy to arrive. But on the 18th of May this year, something happened to help with that third thing. The Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, was killed in a helicopter accident.
I've seen vision of it already. There's a huge plume of smoke coming from that site.
We did a whole episode about it at the time. You can go back and listen after you finish with this one. The president's death opened up an opportunity for Mossad. It knew that Haniyeh would be invited to the inauguration of the new president in July. What happened next is still a little unclear. There's at least three versions of the story. The New York Times and the Jerusalem Post report that the bomb was planted soon after Raisi's death and sat there for 8 weeks waiting for Haniyeh to visit for the event. The Jewish Chronicle in London reports that in fact the bomb was planted on the afternoon of Haniyeh's arrival. But whichever version turns out to be true, we know that by the time Haniyeh turned in for the night on the 30th of July, the bomb had been planted. And it wasn't on a timer. It could be detonated when the time was right. Luckily for Mossad, the building was unbelievably easy to spy on. You can see it clearly from anywhere on the hillside that stretches up behind the palace. You can see it from the chairlift on your way up for a ski. Or you could dress up in green camouflage and climb any of the several hundred trees surrounding the building, which is what the Jewish Chronicle reports that Mossad agents did. Haniyeh attended the inauguration of Iran's new president, met with the country's supreme leader, and then went to the guest house. The agents watched Haniyeh's car arrive. They watched him go into his room, watched him turn off the light, waited a few moments, and then pressed the button. 2 assassinations, 14 years apart. The differences between them tell us a lot about Israel's position in the world. In 2010, Mossad's operation in Dubai really irritated Israel's allies in Europe and Australia. But in 2024, Israel needs those allies more than they've needed them in decades. By carrying out assassinations in Iran, they're operating in a way that is far more risky for their agents, but much less likely to anger their friends. What Mossad does, though, it's different from the CIA or MI6.
CIA people, they don't like this stuff, you know. It's messy.
While British and American spy agencies do assassinate people, they do it in war zones, and they tend to do it with military operations or drone strikes, and they tend to tell the public about it. Why don't they do sneaky James Bond-style assassinations?
Because it was believed to be counterproductive. You're just creating martyrdom, you're creating that feel of persecution, and in the long term, that's negative.
And to top it off, it usually doesn't achieve anything.
All terrorists are replaced sooner or later.
The point of these assassinations is to create fear, to terrorize your opponents, to make your enemies constantly worry that you've planted a bomb under their bed, that the places that they think are safe aren't really.
Israel's basically sending a message to the Iranians, we can kill any one of you, anywhere, anytime. And Iran has very tight security, so it is of concern.
It's the same reason Russia kills people by poisoning their underpants, or their tea, or their doorknobs. Ismail Haniyeh was the chief negotiator in the peace talks aimed at ending the war in Gaza. And now he's been replaced as Hamas leader by a far more fanatical Islamist, Yahya Sinwar. Haniyeh's death potentially indicates an Israeli desire to prolong the war. And it's part of a series of tit-for-tat attacks in recent weeks that could signal an escalation of the conflict. The thing is, though, when Russia pulls stunts like this, they're condemned by the Western world. Israel thinks it's found the guardrails for how to carry out cross-border assassinations without losing friends. But right now, their friendships are quite stretched. They cannot afford to make any mistakes. If You're Listening is written by me, Matt Bevan. Supervising producer is Jess O'Callaghan, and audio production this week is by Anna John. Now, we have done quite a lot of episodes about Israel and Iran. If you haven't heard them, I recommend going back into our back catalogue on the podcast feed and finding them and having a listen, because in my view, they stand up pretty well, given the continuing escalation that we're seeing in the Middle East. I will, meanwhile, be returning back to talking about US politics next week, given the fact that the Democratic National Convention will be on in Chicago. That'll be next week. I'll catch you then.